Hello, and welcome to the WWIA podcast. We're honored to have you join us in our mission to bring honor, connection, and healing to America's combat wounded Purple Heart heroes. If this is your first time listening to this podcast, we welcome you. If you're a returning listener, thanks for coming back. Please be sure to tell others about our podcast and leave us a review if you're enjoying what you're hearing. We have another exceptional guest on this episode of the WWIA podcast. WWIA founder and CEO John McDaniel is honored to share some time and a wonderful conversation with one of America's tremendous Purple Heart heroes and a steadfast friend and supporter of our mission, Mr. Jeremy Smith. Jeremy served 2.5 years in the U.S. Army with the 101st Airborne Division. In 2006, he was injured by mortar shrapnel in Baghdad, Iraq, and was awarded the Purple Heart Medal. After several surgeries and months of physical therapy, he was medically retired from service. Jeremy currently lives in Burke, South Dakota, with his beautiful wife, April, and their daughter, Natalie, and son, Matthew. For the past 3 years, Jeremy has owned and operated Star Lake Outfitters, providing exciting hunting and fishing expeditions. Hunting and fishing have always been a part of his life, but it never played such an important role until now. Since leaving the military, Jeremy has found special solace in the conservation of the outdoors and the tranquility and peace it provides. Jeremy attended his first WWIA event in 2011 and graduated from the inaugural WWIA Guide School in 2016. He's been an active member of WWIA, leading events all over the country. It's with great pride that we introduce you to Jeremy and share some of his journey with you. Without further ado, let's join the conversation with John and Jeremy now.
Hi, I'm John McDaniel, founder and CEO of the Wounded Warriors in Action Foundation. This is our podcast, Honor, Connect, and Heal. So today I have with me one of our illustrious guides, an amazing American who I respect a great deal and know quite well, Jeremy Smith. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So for the folks that don't know, Jeremy and I are looking at each other on a screen. He's not in my office. Where are you right now? Are you in the South Dakota or are you in Virginia?
I am home in South Dakota, Burke, South Dakota.
Okay. Burke, South Dakota. Perfect. So by way of introduction, I met so many people. I'm just trying to think where you and I very first met. And I know it wasn't Camp Hackett. We've been all over the place together because you're a guide, you're a Purple Heart recipient. Can you tell me, do you remember where we first met?
Yes, 2011, MOCAN, before it was MOCAN. It was really just the Missouri Ducks and Bucks.
Right.
Yeah, way early in its infancy.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. Perfect. So anyway, that's where we met. I was impressed by you. You impressed other people. You've been through our guide school. You've been to our safety symposium. And you've helped host and co-host many events. Your leadership is something that we value a great deal. You got a tremendous story. And I want to get to that during the podcast so folks can get to know you a little bit better. But let me ask you, where did you grow up? Let's start there.
Rural New York, so about 80 miles northwest of New York City, in Orange County. Everybody knows the famous Orange County Choppers. That's the county we grew up in. Very rural, farming, dairy stuff, hunting, fishing, everyday part of life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And do they call that upstate? I mean, isn't anything north of the city upstate?
Anything that's not the five boroughs is upstate.
Right? Upstate. Okay, right on. So I remember your story. I remember you telling me once upon a time that your dad was a mechanic.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yeah.
So your dad was a mechanic. And you spent a lot of time with your dad, noting how he fixed things, helping him fix things, and that was sort of the stepping stone, as I recall you telling the story, for you to, when you did get into the Army, you gravitated towards being a mechanic, didn't
Correct.
You?
Correct. Yeah.
So tell us that story. Tell us about, you know, joining the Army and, you know, being a mechanic, and then take us through your service until the time that you get wounded, you earn your Purple Heart, and then we'll go from there. I'd love everybody to hear that story.
Sure. So I graduated high school and thought college was the way. Went to college and just wasn't loving it. So decided to join the Army and went and saw the recruiter with a buddy. My buddy, turns out, doesn't go. I leave, go through MEPS and all that, go to Fort Jackson, which I just found out you had went to Fort Jackson.
I am a basic trainee.
Yeah,
maybe
a few
tank
years
kill.
Before me, but yeah, that was
88.
Pretty neat. But yeah, so when Jackson, I did basic and AIT. So I joined as a 63 Bravo, which is a wheel mechanic. Then I did the Hotel 8 identifier, which was wrecker operator. My dad was a mechanic. He was a heavy tow truck operator. That stuff just kind of fell into place, you know, stuff I liked, enjoyed, and knew. Decided I wanted to go to airborne school, but I had to choose between airborne school and that Hotel 8. And I thought, boy, I'm going to the 101st Airborne. I already knew where my duty station was. Mm-hmm. So I said, I'll go there, become an air assault guy. You know, it's going to be great.
Because even though it says 101st Airborne, back in World War II, they were jumping onto planes. But modern day 101 is, you know, a helicopter assault unit. There might be some worse D guys jumping out of planes, but the division's not a jumping division.
Correct. And I heard, right, so I'm out of the loop now, quite a few years, the 101st got their airborne tab taken, and they're now an air assault unit. It's the 101st air assault. I probably should have done my research on that, but I don't know. That's what it is. But,
God bless them.
But nobody will ever forget them as the 101st Airborne.
Screaming Eagles, baby, right?
Puking chickens, same thing. Yeah, love the history. And glad to have been a part of that. But so I got there. I think it was early 06, got to Campbell. We fast-tracked some training because the division was deployed. They were in Iraq at the time. Mm-hmm. So by April of 2006. It's a big scramble, John. I should have wrote all these dates down.
No, it's a better this way because I'll struggle right with you.
Yeah. April 2006, deployed to Iraq. We were in the thick of it at that point. They'd already been there 6 months. We were just kind of coming, filling gaps. You know, a few of us had flown in and filled in some gaps in the unit. So
what brigade are you in at this point? Fourth brigade. Yep. Okay.
Yeah. Headquarters company. You know, that's where all the mechanics and engineers, we had everybody in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You guys fix a lot of broken stuff. That's your job.
Yeah.
And in a war zone, I bet there's a lot of fixing.
Breaks almost every day. Yeah.
Everything.
Night missions and, you know, running into concrete barricades because you can't see out of those NVGs and driving truck. And yeah, it's interesting stuff.
All of that.
Yeah. So, yeah, we were there. So, like I said, they'd already been there 6 months. So I would have only had about 6 months to do a 12-month tour with them. 11 days before we were coming home, 2ID was coming in to relieve us. At this point in 06, the Iraqis have really understood what the influx of traffic and the patches on our shoulders mean. And they knew this 12-month cycle, right? They learned, hey, now there's going to be an influx of more. So they started to really hammer us with mortar attacks and bombings.
And IEDs are starting to pop their ugly heads up at this point, aren't they?
They were pretty much in the thick of it then. Yeah, if there wasn't a truck that hit one once a week, it wasn't happening. mean, it was all the time.
And for those that don't know, an IED is an improved explosive device. This is where the bad guys, you know, whether they were insurgents, and we could spend a whole, you know, probably podcast session or week on who the bad guys were. But nonetheless, the insurgents that we were fighting had figured out, thanks to, you know, I'm sure some support by other organizations and entities that were fueling the fire, okay, and supporting the bad guys. But they figured out how to take things like 105 howitzers and, you know, mortars and any sort of munition and wire it so that and bury it in the ground on a major route of some sort or an intersection, and then detonate it remotely, you know, not being right at the scene of the, you know, incident, but being able to blow up this improved explosive device, which was basically a bomb that was electronically detonated. And they would do it, timing it on generally during a convoy when there was a series of vehicles moving down the road, and they would usually try to isolate that. So if you detonated this thing when, say, you know, a quarter of the unit was north or south or ahead of the area that was, you know, where the bomb was, where the device was, then, you know, you could separate a force, and then generally there was an ambush or something else that followed, right? So that's the idea of an IED. Sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to explain that because we use that term because we, you know, we lived it. But some folks that are listening to this might not know what IED was. So there you have it. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Yeah, that's a good explanation of it. Yeah, they got crafty with that. You know, within the city of Baghdad, a lot of pavement. So they couldn't just dig a hole and bury those things. They would light fires on the streets to soften the pavement to then be able to dig them up. Yeah, it was wild. They were pretty crafty. They got good at what they were doing.
Yeah.
So 2ID came in to relieve, 11-ish days left of, you know, us leaving. And the attacks started to get heavy while I was trying to work on a truck, fix a fan belt on a Hemet fueler of all things. So thousands of gallons of fuel in this truck. And the first mortar landed. So I get back to the motor sergeant's office, which, if you can call it an office, right? Small concrete building, plywood door, just somewhere where the computer stays dry. So there's about 8 of us tucked in there, just kind of riding out the bombing like you would a rainstorm, you know, mortar shells falling. Mm-hmm. Well, one lands right behind, blows dust through the little back boarded window. And we all just kind of locked eyes like
that was close.
That the next thing you know, they walk them across. So, we're just thinking we're next. And it landed just to the outside edge of the door, on the edge of the concrete sidewalk that was there. So within 4 feet of the door, mortar lands. I was seated with my left side to the door. One of those guys from 2ID was standing in the doorway. So he took quite a bit of shrapnel. He did not die, thank God, because that would have really made a terrible moment for me. But so I was struck in the left leg and shoulder with mortar shrapnel, broke my tibia. I think 5 of us out of the 8 that were in there were wounded. So we scrambled and got out, and, you know, our medics tended to us and flew us off to somewhere. There was kind of a big haze there for a little while, lots of drugs and not understanding what's going on. And Sergeant Major Coop, who you
are. Oh, yeah, I know. Great American.
Yeah, he came to see me before I left country.
Timothy Coop, right?
That's right. Yeah. So he came with my first sergeant at the time, who I can't remember, which is terrible, but he was a great guy too. But Sergeant Major Coop and First Sergeant came, made sure I satellite phoned home. But I knew, you know, my dad being a Vietnam vet and already worried that I deployed, I didn't want to call him and tell him I was wounded. So Sergeant Major gives me this phone. I call him and I told him I broke my leg because I tripped. And Coop is standing there looking at me. Sergeant Major gives me this look, and I was, he's like, "You." He just takes the phone from me and he tells him what's going on. And, you know, I'll be okay and they'll send me home and no problem. Don't worry about it. And just click. That's it.
So, wow.
Yeah. So then a few shuffles, you know, go up to Germany for a week. I was in Longstuhl for a week, which was pretty neat. Had a friend stationed in Germany, so he took the train down, visited with me for an hour or two. The same friend that I originally tried to enlist with, he later did get in.
I'll be darned.
Stationed in Germany, finds out somehow, I don't know if my wife or one of my other friends had let him know, but yeah, he found out where I was and came to Longstuhl and visited with me for a little bit. So that was kind of cool.
Cool.
A little bit of home away from home.
Right, right.
Yeah. And then hopped, you know, a couple different bases, got back to Fort Campbell, spent some time in the hospital there, and the surgeons did some operations and removed some shrapnel and closed some wounds. But they couldn't put me in a hard cast because of the amount of wounds to fix that bone. So I had a soft cast that you weren't supposed to really walk on. But of course, we're going to do it. So I may have prolonged my healing process by not following all the rules, but we're stubborn and we're men and that's what we do.
Hard-headed.
Absolutely. Yeah.
A little hard-headed.
Yeah.
That's how that works, yeah. Right? Or you wouldn't be doing what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, we lived on base. My wife and I lived on base at the time, and the only bathroom in the home was upstairs. Well, I couldn't stay upstairs all day, so I'd be downstairs and then have to scoot up and downstairs. And it was kind of a hassle, but
yeah,
made it through and we're here. And
not a awesome. Really big deal. Yeah. So, well, I appreciate you sharing that story with us. You know, we have one of the common themes that I see a lot because I do these podcasts with y'all, and it's easy for me to kind of see some of those themes that run throughout. And one of them keeps popping up in my mind anyway, is just the idea of being resilient, you know, and having to deal with tragedy and, you know, being wounded and then all of a sudden at some point, you know, you are either told or you recognize that the one thing you wanted to do, which was go serve your country, that there's an end coming to that faster perhaps than you expected. Like your timeline is been shortened, and that realization is either hits you or alternatively, guys are like, you know, I was up, my enlistment time was up, and I just thought that I had done, you know, enough. And so I, you know, decided to get out of the service. So which one of those two scenarios, I mean, fast forwarding through your recovery period, you know, you obviously got out of the service. Did the service tell you, did the Army tell you, hey, you know, love you, but you got to go? Or did you reach your, you know, ETS date in your time of service and said, I'm done? What happened there?
No, I was kind of pushed out. There was no love you bye. It was, hey, get out of the way. We need bodies. And yours isn't working.
Right. Right.
So they just kind of pushed me out. I tried to appeal it to go to the med board.
Yeah, you got med board, yeah, is right, what they say, right?
Yeah, so medically discharged.
Right.
And I was based supposed to appear in front of the medical board, and this very sweet colonel called me, and she talked me out of coming down. You know, here I am, E4 Smith, and this is Colonel so-and-so, head of this medical board, and she said, don't waste your time, don't waste your unit's money, we're not going to change our minds, it's not worth appealing your case, you're done. Yes, ma'am.
Well, at least it's straight talk, right? At least it's not...
Yeah. And
you know, guys like us appreciate straight talk. It might be a pill I don't want to swallow.
Yeah.
But at least it's straight talk, right?
Yeah. So I did not go. I tucked tail and left.
Wow.
And then went right back to working because I had no choice. You don't just sit around and do nothing.
Right. So you're still at this point, when you get out, you stay at Campbell or you go back to New York? What do you do?
Moved back to New York. That's my wife and I were both from New York. I had a job mm-hmm. lined up with a guy I worked for before, like mm-hmm. during high school at a machine shop. Mm-hmm. Went back to work for him. Ran that machine shop. We used to build parts for elevators that we shipped down to Manhattan. Mm. It was a pretty neat deal. Lots of learning there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. And so at some point, I mean, so, you were hurt. You got wounded in 06?
Correct. Yep. October 28th.
You meet me in 11 at MOCAN. So 5 years go by.
Right.
You go to MOCAN. Who's on that event? Jake?
Jake Wipke.
Jake Wipke.
Yeah.
God bless you. You two are like brothers of sorts, you know. Love you both, man. But you meet Jake and you're at MOCAN and I'm there, right?
Correct.
Like you said, I was there.
Yep.
Okay. So I've been there a few times, so I don't remember, you know, I want to say the first MOCAN would have been like 2009, I think. So it was a couple of years.
Yeah, would be the year before. So in 2011, you were still staying in the hotel. There was no
gun
club.
Those were the old days. Yeah.
So I was invited back in 2012 by those guys because we did not harvest any deer. They know I've been deer hunting for like 13 years and never killed one. So they made sure I came back on the 12 event, and that was the first year we ever stayed at Napier, which is now just
it's a monster. It's a
beauty there. That place.
Yeah, it's like the Taj Mahal of duck hunting and deer hunting. Yeah, they did a great job with that,
didn't they?
Terry Supple and crew, and you know Brian Roderick, of course. I mean, it just sounds like Brian. Oh, well, you're coming back. You know, you didn't get a deer. I can just hear him. You know. So that's awesome. So you came back, we met, and then, you know, at some point you got identified and roped into guide school. You went to our guide school.
Right.
And then, you know, you started leading missions. This is with the part of the grand plan, you know, you guys leading missions without, you know, me being around, and things just kind of have gone from there. Let me ask you this. Okay. Cause I like to, I'm always fascinated by people's answers, you guys' answers to this question. But you obviously, you know, you said when we kicked off the program that you like to hunt and you fish, you like to hunt and fish, and you're an outdoorsman. You grew up in upstate New York. So all of that makes a lot of sense to me. You have a servant's mentality. And I mean that in the most affectionate way, meaning, hey, you joined the Army in a time of war. Okay. You volunteered. There was no draft.
Right.
You said, I'm going. My dad served in Vietnam. I'm going. Okay. So you go and you get wounded. You get, you know, discharged, medically boarded out. And then you find this organization, WWIA. You go on an event and you don't get a deer. They have you come back. I didn't know that. That doesn't surprise me because at all. There's zero surprise in that for me because. Like I don't micromanage, you know, down to that level. If Brian said, "Hey, I want this guy back," you're coming back, you know, and I respect that. You know, that's part of the program, is trusting your, you know, your leaders out there to do the right thing, whatever they think that right thing might be. And so I'm not surprised at all that happened. Actually, it makes me feel good that it did happen. You know, I'm learning of something that happened, you know, 14 years ago. You know, it's hard to believe that it was that long ago, but, you know, right there you go. So that's beautiful. And then, but my question is, you know, what, now that you're in this space and you're serving, and we'll get to what you're doing in the Dakotas and with your pheasant operation and your guide service, because I want to hit that pretty hard next. But, what do you get out of this? You know, when you're doing your job as a guide, interacting with the other combat wounded Purple Heart recipients in the field on one of our missions, whether that's your own or another, and you're doing this thing, what do you get out of it? When it's all said and done and it's over, the guys leave, or you get back on a plane or get in your truck and drive home, and you have some windshield time or tractor time, and you're thinking about what you just did, what are you left with?
Well, it's just a completely humbling experience, John. You talk to some of these guys, you know, I had a very short-lived military career, kind of forced out. Short, sweet, done. You know, some of these guys have done 20, 25 years. Some are still active. Two Purple Hearts, several deployments.
14. I know of a dude who's done 14. It's probably more than that now, but you can't even get your head around 14 deployments.
Yeah, leaving their family every 6 to 12 months, 4, 6 to 12, 8 months at a time. Just absolutely incredible to be sharing a blind or a tree stand or even just the truck ride in the morning with these guys. I went through dark times. It was bad. The foundation has been my saving grace. So to get back together with these guys and talk to them and hang out and just be us.
Yeah, you know, it's a lifetime of stuff, right?
It is.
You get, and it just keeps, the layers just keep getting, you know, deeper and more meaningful. And, you know, it's like when you see some of these guys after you've spent, you know, time together in the field doing something and you see them again, man, it's just like instantaneous bond. Like, you know, and I don't know how you describe that feeling, but to be able to serve them, the reason I'm saying this is because I feel the same way you do. I feel exactly the same way. It's an honor. You know, it's hard for me to describe in any meaningful way. What does that mean to do an event at Camp Hackett and serve these heroes, or have been on MOCAN and, you know, seen the smiles and got to know guys and share that experience, and then get away from it and go, I was just doing that for 4 days, and I feel like, I always call it the post-event coma. You know, I always feel like how do you sort through the emotions that you just had? How do you sort through the feelings that are running through your veins? You know, how do you sort through, you know, how complex and yet how simple it all was? And what does that mean to you? And so I go through personally much of the same. And so when I hear somebody like you say it, I just go, wow, you know, I appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah, it's definitely special. And I like to check in with those guys that we're with, you know, a little bit later in the year, 2 years later. I'm thinking about one of the guys right now. He was on the North Dakota hunting event with me last year. Haven't really touched base with him lately. That event's coming makes me think, hey, I should shoot him a message, see what he's up to.
Yeah.
And the hosts do the same thing, and it's fun. You know, you just get a random message. It could be 2 or 3 years later, and somebody just shoots you a message like, hey, I just saw this memory, and I was thinking about you. What's going on? Like, do you remember when we were doing this? And it's just a great time. And, you know, memories that'll never be taken away from us.
That's right. So now, You're in South Dakota. You've got this pheasant operation, a guide service connected to a pheasant operation. I'd like to hear about that. Can you tell us, share that with us a little bit?
Sure. We 3 years ago, I bought Star Lake Outfitters, or I bought out another company, renamed it Star Lake Outfitters.
Okay.
We primarily pheasant hunt. We can chase grouse and chucker and partridge and prairie chicken. We have all those on our lease. The lease is 1,800 acres just south of the town of Gregory, which is 8 miles west of me. Population 1,200 over there. It's a pretty big place around here. So we are in the thick of it. We are in pheasant country. They call it the Golden Triangle.
Okay.
It's great habitat. Good stuff.
Awesome.
We have a lot of fun with it. Have a 4-bedroom lodge in town.
Is that how you do it? You got the lodge in town, and then you meet the guys, and you go out. Guys got dogs. That's great. Guys don't have dogs. What are they, just beating the brush?
No.
Are you got dogs?
Yeah,
what's going on?
I fully guide every hunt. Sometimes we have guys who come in, they want to DIY their own stuff, and we'll let them do it. Or if they have a dog, it's welcome to join us. But yeah, I've got four crazy labs and a little wild pointer who is trying to learn the ropes here, but we'll get her in step.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, so I'm sorry. I just got to say it because it's like something I feel like it's like the elephant in the room. Why don't you do an event there?
Thought about it. My concern is fundraising, right?
Yeah.
I've hosted an event in Virginia. I know what events cost and what events take. And these are small communities, and they all pour their hearts out to everybody.
Yeah. Is there a VFW or a American Legion post or something like, right? See, okay. Anyway, let's not get into that too deeply. Yeah. And I certainly don't want to push this on you. Okay. By any means, but I just am like, I got to hear why. And I understand that the fundraising piece is a part of it, because this is expensive business, right? Especially getting to South Dakota. I mean, I assume they'd have to fly into like Bismarck.
No, you could fly to Sioux Falls.
But Sioux Falls,
it's a
2.5-hour
drive after that.
After Sioux Falls, yeah.
Yeah, so you fly probably all day.
Let's chat about that.
Yeah, let's chat about that.
Yeah. We can do this. If you have the will, buddy.
Oh, well, we want to host.
Do you? Let's do that. I think we can.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So what we've done in place of that was just donate a hunt to raise money to help other events.
Yeah. No, let's.
It's been great.
Let's just make this happen.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's chat afterwards. But I think it's a great idea. If that's something you and your family want to do, let's not let money stop us. You know what I mean? Because I can guarantee you we can make this happen.
Make it happen.
Piece of cake, man. I know we can. All right. So that's good. All right. Awesome. So you now, are you raising birds too? Is that what's going on?
No,
they're all natural?
No, they're not. There are wild birds out there, right?
Yep.
So pheasant's not a native species. It was introduced into the Americas back in the late 1800s, and it's had its rise and fall. There are good wild bird populations, but no commercial outfitter, no matter how hard they tell you, I'm going to spoil the industry, spoil their secrets here. You cannot hunt a wild population in the quantities that these guys do.
Yeah.
In fact, the state mandates that hunting preserves, like we have a hunting preserve, it lets us extend our season and our limits and our regulations.
Right.
We have to release at least 600 birds a year within those acres.
Yeah, and some of those are going to get shot. Some of them are going to get eaten by fox.
Oh,
some of them are going to survive and reproduce.
Yep.
You know, so, right? Isn't this, it's like stocking a pond with fish.
Yep. You just have to put in more than you take out. That's all.
Right.
Yep. No,
that's
big
right.
Deal.
Yep. I grew up in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And my dad was a big pheasant hunter. We had Irish setters of all things. And so he would go out on opening day. You could take opening day in Wisconsin was, I think it the some Saturday in October. It may have been September, but in the fall. And it opened at noon, and you were allowed to take two birds. That was the limit.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no farm. I mean, these were wild birds, you know. I mean, there was no anywhere around us I am unaware of, and I know there wasn't any stocked birds. But if you took, you know, and he would hunt until he got at least one, and sometimes he would come home with two. But it was like a banner day. Like that was for my dad, and it was a solo event. Like he didn't say, "Hey, I want you to take off of school."
Yeah.
You know, my dad did this for him and his dog, you know? And I I'll always have fond memories, pheasant hunting. When that bird decides to get up off the ground from its little hide location and just bust off with a, you know, a rooster with a cackle.
Yeah.
You know, and they come up like a helicopter, and then they decide to go, you know, and it's a nice big target, and they're so beautiful.
They are.
They're delicious to eat. Yeah. I mean, I love that bird. It's a great game bird. And, you know, I mean, there's just something about it sitting there with that and holding this thing, you know, especially when you throw in the dog piece, you know, the dogs are working and this thing, you know, dog retrieves and brings it to your hand. I mean, it's just an amazing thing. So I'm happy you're doing that. And it sounds to me like some of that bug has got to you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love it. I wouldn't change it for the world now. My wife hates South Dakota and as cold as it is. And I said, we can live somewhere else all year long, but when it comes time to be here for hunting season, we're back. So get over it, honey.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, you know, I appreciate what you're doing, and it's not easy. You know, that's being a guide, a professional guide as a professional outfitter. You know, that's not easy because, you know, you're out in the middle of nowhere. So Star Lake Outfitters, do you have a website?
Yep. Just starlakeoutfitters.com.
Okay. So if anybody's listening to this and wants to go have an amazing experience with Jeremy, how do they get a hold of you? They go on the website and there's a link for them to communicate with you or what?
Yeah, website's got my phone number. It's got an email. It's got a contact us button. Everything's in there.
Okay, cool. Star Lake Outfitters and Jeremy Smith. God bless you, man. So here we are. Tell us a little bit about your family, because I know you're a family man. I respect that a great deal. And I'd like to hear about your family if you got a few minutes.
Yeah, my kids are getting big. My daughter is in her second year of college. She's going to an LPN course here in South Dakota, about 2 hours away. Mm-hmm. My son's a high school senior now. Just crazy, you know.
That's nuts, man.
It is.
That's nuts. What's he going to do? Does he know yet?
He's got no clue. We're really trying to groom that out of him right now and see what's happening. He's not sure. The world is his oyster. But what's really neat is I got a call from a very good friend of mine yesterday, and he said, hey, your son's been asking me about Skunk Works, some secret squirrel stuff that Lockheed Martin does. And so he's researching things. He's asking the right people about
good,
you know, neat things that are happening in the world. Mm-hmm. So we'll figure it out.
Cool.
Yeah, if he's not in school, he's out there hunting with me. So
he loves it.
Yeah, running dogs, chasing doves, whatever we're doing.
Cool.
Yeah, he'll drive an hour to go see friends and goose hunt. And yeah, he's ate up. The bug has got him.
That's awesome, man. Well, you look good. You look like you're healthy and in a good spot. I hope that's the case. We certainly appreciate all that you've done to support the foundation over the years and by way of, you know, being a guide and a friend and just a general supporter. I mean, you're one of those guys, man, and I appreciate it.
Well, thanks, John. I appreciate you. Without you and the foundation, I may not be sitting here today, and you know that.
Yeah, buddy. Well, listen, man, I mean, we're proud of you and honored to have you in our inner circle. You know, and we're just getting warmed up. Let's chat and we'll end this podcast. I always like to give my guest the last whack at the pinata. So if you've got some saved rounds in your bandolier that you'd like to fire off, then by all means, the floor is yours, my friend.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that. You know, none of this happens without our hosts and our supporters and our guides. You know, thank you to all of them and for your vision. You know, this started with you just wanting to do something. I remember you saying this very early on about just kind of like, hey, I am seeing my soldiers hurting and needing something. What can I do? So none of this happened without you, John. So thank you.
I'm just blessed to be, honestly, I'm blessed to be, you know, part of it, that you have an idea that other people like and, you know, can get behind. And, you know, to look at it now through the lens of almost coming up on 20 years, you know, and see the goodness it's created, mostly because of people like you and, like you said, our hosts and supporters who've gotten behind this and helped, has really made this something very, very valuable. in the sense of the work that it's doing. And it's not just in, you know, focusing on our combat wounded. Of course, that's the centerpiece. You guys are the centerpiece, the reason that we're doing this. But there's also so many other good things that are happening that are, you know, tangential to that or connected to that in a way, by way of community support, and by way of, hey, it's a channel people can get behind. Like, this is a pathway. If I wanted to help, I want to serve, I don't know what I can do. And the foundation always finds a way to get people involved. You just got to take that step. And once you do take that step, you know, what usually follows is several other steps.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
People are like,
step.
Yeah, take that step, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes it's a hard step, but you need to take it.
That's right. That's right. Don't be afraid, man. Take that step. Do something, you know? And so anyway, well, listen, God bless you. We'll end this and then, we'll chat. Stay on the line for a minute, 'cause I got some ideas about, you know, Star Lake Outfitters and the WWI working together a little bit, more in a formal way. So, thank you very much. God bless you and your family, my friend.
Thank you.
And yeah, it's great to see you. Okay.
Yeah, you too, John. Thanks.
All right. We're out.
Thank you for listening to the WWIA podcast. To learn more about the Wounded Warriors in Action Foundation and how you can get involved, please visit our website at wwiaf.org. Or follow us on social media on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. If you'd like to comment or offer feedback about our podcast, or if you have a suggestion for a future episode, please email us at podcast@wwiaf.org. Thank you for your support and for helping us honor, connect, and heal our combat wounded Purple Heart heroes through the power of the great outdoors.